are listening to a message from Stonegate Church. For more information about Stonegate and additional audio resources, please visit stonegate.church.
Let's start here. That whole idea of a re-enchanted world. Mm-hmm. Maybe give us a little bit of additional thoughts on what it would look like to see the world re-enchanted. You know, we're walking right back into our work weeks and school and life and jobs and everything else in between, but we are living in just this secular, this mindset. Mm. And what would that look like for us to experience that, to live that out, even starting tomorrow?
Yeah. Well, I think of Spurgeon, who talked about some people walk by the ocean and they just hear the waves. Some people just hear wind. But a Christian who knows that all these things have been made by our Father, they hear music. There's an underlying music, and I love in the way Narnia puts it, there's a deeper magic at work to where I don't have to just walk into the clock. I'm not just walking in some mechanical thing. I'm actually living in this organic, physical world that has a spiritual creator over it. And so I just think, man, just go for a walk sometime. Enjoy. It's fall weather. It's beautiful. What would it be like for you to take a 15-minute walk to pray and to receive the fall air as a gift from your Father? Like, there's an enchantment even in the breeze. There's an enchantment listening to the leaf. I went hunting on Saturday, took my son out hunting. And thing about hunting is you can't talk. And since my son is with me, he can't have phones while we're hunting. So it's probably the most boring time for him that he's ever had. But for me, I'm just sitting there listening to the wind. I'm watching the animals, little birds fly, and, you know, just possums, all these things run by. I'm like, man, this place is wonderful. God really did make a good world. And there's something deeper happening here if we let ourselves feel it and engage in it. It doesn't have to be just noise. It can be music.
So. Yeah, I think you're saying something really insightful. One of the biggest maybe cautions or obstacles we have to just being overcome by this secular world that we find ourselves in is even just the pace. Yeah. You know, to stop and notice the wind or a leaf or a branch or God's creation around us requires us to slow down.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think sometimes one of the things that's been part of the rise of secularity is the pace of life in which we live at.
Absolutely.
So, and I think that's true even for our discipleship of Jesus. We have to slow down a lot.
Yeah.
If we're going to spend time with Jesus, but probably also to be re-enchanted, like you're mentioning.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a question for you though. This is something I think the enchantment thing is a great question. Go home, start a fire pit, sit outside, read the stars, and you're cured. You'll be enchanted. But the question I have for you, and we were getting several questions along the lines, I made a comment about how you could even be secular and be in the church, be raised in the church and have a secularist mindset. Do you think that's true? How have you seen secularism in the church interplay?
Yeah, I think actually that's so important what you're talking about. I don't think atheism has become one of the biggest obstacles for us in engaging in conversations or evangelism or even our own lives. I think it's anthropology. So not atheism, but anthropology. When the human is center. The human is not meant to live for themselves, and when they do live for themselves, they end up by themselves, and yourself is never enough to satisfy. Mm-hmm. And so it is possible to be a Christian and still, or to claim to be in the church, to claim to be a Christian or a follower of Jesus, and still have yourself at the center. You'll hear us talk about Stonegate, a God-centered theology. And I think what we're saying in that is what has the most mass in your life? What has the most weight in your life? It's actually another way to describe the glory of God, weight. Like, what gets the most weight? What is everything orbiting around? And if God is still orbiting around you and just the earthly desires and ambitions and needs, it's still, you could be in the church but still be more self-centered or human-centered than God-centered. So what is the primary preoccupation for us when we are waking up each day? Are we looking and seeing this really is God's world? Yeah. God is at work in this world. God is moving in this world. God's moving in my life. This is the day the Lord has made. Mm. Like, do I believe that? That is an enchanting belief, to believe that the Lord has made the day that you're about to live out. As Rodney preached on a couple weeks ago, too, just truly believing, settling in your soul, if you're God-centered, that there are good works that have been prepared in advance for you to do.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know what, it's just another mundane, repetitive day, driving into the office. I'm going to complete the same rote tasks. Mm. I'm going to go through the same boring mechanical motions over and over, and it's void of meaning.
Yeah.
So these things are profoundly theological, but I think it really does emanate. Is God center or are we center?
Yeah.
In how we're interpreting the days and the weeks and the months and the years that we're living.
Yeah. Yeah, you're hitting on something really important. I think you gave a couple of different things there on that, but I think one of the primary things is around the self. You know, you can go read Carl Truman's book.
Yeah, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self.
Modern Self.
I think that's like there's a smaller one too, if you guys look it up on Amazon. Yeah. Because that's like a 500 page, and then he came out with like a 200 page, but it's brilliant on this. Yeah,
totally. One of the things that I think that tends towards secularism is this idea of this individualisticness that happens. And we're not saying that God hasn't uniquely created you. I love to use the analogy. I've heard it before from somebody else, but you know, we're fine saying that every snowflake is unique. But you're just as unique as every snowflake, so you're not unique. You know, I mean, there's this idea of like all the snowflakes are unique that were made by God, and yet we're interconnected as a whole. So we're not trying to tell people that your individuality doesn't matter. We're not saying that. What we are saying is your individuality is not the main story that's happening. It's a piece of the puzzle. It's not the whole puzzle. It's one piece of that thousand pieces.
It's so true. Another book I'd recommend you guys is a book called Total Truth by Nancy Piercy. Percy or Piercy? Mm-hmm. We'll go with Piercy. It's a brilliant book too, Total Truth. And she actually talks about like cultures and even moments in time. They tend to gravitate to certain segments. They're overly reductionistic. They tend to gravitate to certain segments of what it means to be human. And Justin's really was teaching on even a lot tonight, even the Enlightenment, which was the movement that was led by a guy named René Descartes, his famous phrase, I think, therefore I am. And what he did in that moment is he located the primary truest thing about me is what I think, what I think. And I think the Enlightenment has still been haunting us in some ways. We go through life and we think that the primary and truest thing about me is what I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you go back to Augustine, he was making the argument that actually the truest thing about you is what you love. And so there are some conversations here, too, of it's not that we're saying we want to be anti-science or push back against science, but we just want to be whole people, that you're taking into account what you love, what you think, what you believe, what you have trust in, all of those facets of what it means to be human and not be reductionistic.
That's right. That's good. That's good.
Let me ask you another question. So we have seen just the rise of some of those voices, like a Dawkins, who you're mentioning tonight, or a Jordan Peterson. And some of those voices have talked about what would it look like as you're living as though you are a Christian or as God exists? Like, why not just do that? Like, maybe you've come to the conclusion of going, you know what? I don't know if I really want to go all the way with Jesus as Lord, but I love that cultural Christianity. I love what it's done to form the West and civilizations and cultures, and it seems to be a better alternative than maybe the meaninglessness of secularism.
Yeah. Yeah. So the reality is we get a lot of people right now falling in love with the shadows of Christianity. That's how I explain it. It's kind of this idea of we like the Christian life. We like the Christian virtue. As Christians, we're teaching things like compassion for one another, loving your neighbor. All those things are a really good message for people, and they love that. One of the things I think that is in the work ahead of us in evangelism is to press the issue. If you like the shadow's only good if there's a substance, right? The shadow's only good if there's a substance. You're treating, like Jordan Peterson, you're treating this all as myth, but the myth is only good news if at least most of it's real, right? So this whole idea of Jordan Peterson fascinated with Genesis, fascinated with this story and believes that the story is transformative to live a flourishing life. He's teaching people you should live according to the principles found in the Bible, and they're all myth. And I'm like, well, there's a lot of other myths out there. I mean, there's totally. Other religions that have really great mythology, and yet you've chosen this myth over the mythology of the Greeks or the Egyptian mythology, the Babylonian mythology. You've chosen this one. Well, why? Because it makes better claims? Well, why does it make better claims? At the end of the day, this has got to be more than myth, and you've got to anchor it down to at least reality. if it's going to be good news. So if you love the shadow, you've got to love the substance. You can live the shadow life all you want, living a good life and trying to replicate Christian principles, but what you're going to find is it's still thin because it's just a shadow.
Yeah, and I think you're right. Like, the equipping moment that I hope we all walk in away with a little bit is, like, let's find gentle but also clear and compelling ways to press these issues. You know, press into the places where there is some inconsistency or people are borrowing from a Christian heritage to still say, I want to keep this as part of my worldview, but I want to get rid of the rest, and help them see, actually, no, it all goes together. I can't just say I want to keep some of the cultural influence or maybe even morality, but I want to get rid of other parts of it. But it's a whole package system if you're going to buy into it. And you're really going to believe. So I think that's part of it, too. There's a book I'd recommend by a guy named Greg Kokel that's called Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. And he's making a joke, obviously, of, like, you will find people in this cultural moment. I remember talking to a college student in Seattle years ago when I was pastoring at a church up there. And he had just the most passionate convictions toward justice, toward what was right and wrong, toward equality, toward how people ought to be treated, all of these things. And really what I discovered, as strong as his convictions were, his logic for them were about as thin as tissue paper. Yeah. So just one quick question of, well, where are you grounding that? Where are you getting that? Because secularism, naturalism, is not going to get you there. And right. I think it's fair for us in those conversations to point it out.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Okay, I've got a few other questions here for you. Okay, so let's go back to the naturalism thing. So how can we talk about the natural world without sounding like superstitious people, right? So I just think we got a Bible that talks about, like, at the end of Job, God says things like, I feed the lions, I show the morning where to rise and where the sun set, all that. How do you engage in this highly scientific world that has a lot of natural law? How do you engage with that as a Christian who also believes that God is governing all that?
Yeah, you know, I think another book I'd recommend is The God Hypothesis by Stephen Meyer. He did us such a favor in going back and looking at some of the biographies of some of the most noteworthy scientists that we'd all know. One of them being Newton. And Newton, most of his scientific endeavor was fueled by an act of worship. So genuinely believing and thinking, I am trying to understand the how, but the how does not tell me the why. Mm. So as Christians, we can fully buy in and say, yeah, let's understand the how. How is the body made? How is the solar system function? How does the solar system function? How does the planet spin? All of those questions of how, there's so much freedom for us to engage in and be curious about, and we don't have to bury our heads in the sand. We're not flat earthers. We're not any of that. But it does not tell you the why. In fact, so much of what we're learning in science does is it continues to point us toward conclusions or implications or inferences that actually science gets very nervous about and doesn't like. Hmm. Look at the fine-tuning argument. I often challenge some of my, like, very scientific, secularist, naturalistic friends of, like, hey, that fine-tuning argument's going to eat you alive if you keep thinking about it.
Yeah.
You know, the conditions of our world and our universe are just so for the existence of life. The odds are astronomically impossible that our universe would be set up the way it is. And if you move any of those dials, there's over 40 of them in physics, if you move any of them even slightly, the universe doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Same with the origins of life. I mean, over and over and over again, you see fine-tuning play itself out.
Yeah.
So I don't think Christians have to be afraid of all at all in engaging in scientific arguments. Let's do that, and let's do it to the glory of God. But understanding the how will never actually lead us to the why.
Yeah. You sent me something fascinating that I think is, we just celebrated Halloween.
Yeah.
Celebrated. Most of us engage. Yeah, you know, when Jimmy celebrated Halloween. amazing, cool story. Jimmy basically he stole Satan's car and drove it around the block for a few. And
joyriding.
What was it, like 3,000 people, 2,000 people get prayed for? Yeah, there you go. So I think about Christmas and Halloween. I think about Redeem Halloween. I also think about the Twitter rabbit hole that you sent me down with the whole Nightmare Before Christmas Twitter thread.
Yeah.
How do things like Christmas and Halloween, how is this attesting to the fact that secularism is actually dying?
Yeah, I would love to hear your thoughts on it. But I really think we're actually seeing, as you said, about 70 years ago at the cover of Time magazine, the proclamation that God was dead, and we've taken that for a test drive, and we've found that that's actually gotten us nowhere. And you've even seen a lot of movies that have leaned into like very nihilistic themes as we've tried full-on materialism. I mean, the West has done materialism better than any culture or civilization in human history over the last 60, 70 years, but yet we find ourselves more depressed and anxious than any people group in human history. Well, why is that? I think it is some of this of what's going on. You were talking about the shadow before, but I actually think in many ways we are a Christ-haunted culture.
Yeah.
So we're haunted by Christ. We still know and we want to hold on to. We want to watch the movies. We want to even celebrate something about Christmas. We want to grab something that we feel like was there before, but we can't seem to get a hold of it. So the thing I was sending Justin was I was reading something that a guy wrote recently about The Nightmare Before Christmas.
That's a great movie, by the way. I went and watched it.
Did you watch it?
Twice, actually.
Did you? In the deer blind?
Well, you can't do it
yeah,
there.
Yeah, not there.
I did it before church this morning.
Did you really?
I woke up early enough to finish it.
I kind of believe you.
The songs are great. Yeah. So, yeah.
But the whole movie, maybe you can give us a better update of what it's about. But the character is trying to dissect and go, why does this holiday have meaning?
Yeah.
And trying to understand it. Trying to put it together. Like, why would a culture continue to hold on to it?
Totally. I mean, that's the whole story. I mean, yeah. The Jack, the skeleton guy, the creepy guy. By the way, that movie's creepy. Tim Burton, somebody get his number, offer him a psychologist. But still, movie's great. You get Jack, who basically does all the moves of Christmas, thinks he can get the ornaments, give out the gifts, wear the red hat, you know, all these different things, and thinks he can replicate Christmas and finds out he's missing the deeper magic of whatever Christmas actually is. And I was like, the whole point of that Twitter thread that you sent was that's essentially our world, right? We love we actually are kind of secretly loving the spiritual in many ways, and we're revealing our craving for the spiritual in many ways. Halloween is one aspect of that, where it's like, is one of the reasons why that night, in among many of them, are more spiritual than a lot of others, where people think about death and afterlife and ghouls and ghosts and zombies and what's it going to be like when you die and all that kind of stuff. And then we turn around in Christmas and we create an enriching myth to try to add, it's like we're decorating ourselves with meaning, but we still can't really figure out what brings us meaning.
Yeah, I think we're just haunted by it.
Yeah.
In some ways, there is something we long for and even pine for still, and that just remains in every of us because we're image bearers. Like, our hearts are restless until they find rest in God. So totally. Let me ask you this, and this is a question that is, it's kind of got some Ecclesiastes vibes to it, but a secularist, say someone who's walking here at night, or maybe they're listening, they have more of that mindset, maybe they just believe that one doesn't need to believe in God to enjoy the good things of life. Mm. Like, I can enjoy all the good things of life, like my life looks like it's going really well, I got all the boxes checked, everything's going well. Would you look at this and say this is more of an intellectual problem or a heart problem? And what does it look like to start a conversation with that person to help them recognize maybe there is a deeper need, a longing that they really are feeling?
Yeah, I would argue that every problem is a heart problem, first and foremost. I think it's Augustine that drew everything down to the affections. Everything about your life shows what you love, you know, at the end of the day. And I think that there are a lot of people who are looking at this world and they're like, I've got a good wife, I've got kids, I've got a house, I've got a 401k that's set up. And this is where we're really asking the question of, like, you're probably not on your deathbed when you're asking that question. You're probably not waiting for the results of the tumor and its growth to come in. Because I've been a pastor for 17 years, and I rarely find people who are in medical situations like that saying that they're content with their 401k. It eventually runs out. Like to me, it's just the whole memento mori kind of thing. It's like, we live in a culture that needs that whisper in their ear. It's like, yeah, you got a great house, and someone else is going to live in it someday. Like, your version of meaning and significance and joy and goodness and the epitome of pleasure. This is John Piper, right? So it's like, your epitome of pleasure last your life expectancy and no further. Are you willing to bank that this life really is all there is? I mean, that's a risky bet, that the best thing about life and the best thing about that you can ever have joy in is your house, your 401k. And we just want to call the bet. You know, we want to call the bet. We want to put that chip down on the table and be like, okay, yeah, but okay, this world set aside, yeah, you can live a great life in this world. What about death, though? And let's face it, if we give it enough time, you'll be griping about your big house. You'll be griping about there not being enough money in the 401k. The discontentment sets in. The cracks and the discontentment of the things of this life are self-evident in many ways. It's like, you just give it time, and it's like, every person's eventually going to become a natural grumbler when they're putting their stock in this world alone. It's why, yeah. I mean, I just think about some of the wealthiest people in the world that are secularists, and it's like, you know, apparently, not, and I don't mean apparently like maybe they are. It's like, no, they are apparently, they're saying that they're not happy with life. Yeah. It's like, that seems to be evidence to me.
Yeah, we have a similar question that just says, what do you do when you encounter that neighbor or someone who does have that sentiment of like, we just don't need God anymore? Yeah. And I would say, you know, this is where, with compassion, you play the long game with people. This is where relationship really does matter and be in someone's life. Because if you're in someone's life long enough, here's what you'll discover. They have suffered, they're about to suffer, or they are suffering. Mm. And in those moments of suffering, when you run into those real trials, those pits, even as we've been talking about through the story of Joseph here at Stonegate, I find a lot of that radically begins to change.
Yeah.
Or as you age, life just gives you a little bit more humility. You find that some of your own hubris or your own plans, they just fall by the wayside. Things you thought were going to go a certain way, your marriage was going to look a certain way, yeah, your kids were going to turn out a certain way, your career was going to go, all of those plans that we had that we just felt so high on the horse,
yeah,
life has a way of humbling us all.
That's right.
Yeah. And none of us get out of this thing without some of those moments that come along. And I think sometimes the way we're going to view life and even view our need for God change radically in those moments.
Yeah. We probably have time for one more. It's just the clock is saying that there's probably time. It's probably time. So let's just talk about last 10%. If you were giving, if it was just Ryan Kearns here at the table with someone, they have a secular neighbor. What is Ryan's approach to engaging with a neighbor who says things like, I don't really have a room for belief in God. I just really think that there's just this. I'm just trying to live my life and go on. How would you engage that conversation with a secularist, you personally? How do you begin the journey towards the gospel?
Yeah, that's such a good question. You know, I was saying this a little bit at the outset, but every single person you're encountering, they are kind of answering some of those basic questions that you and I answer, that the Bible story is answering. I'm trying to hear in their story their understanding of creation. Like, why are they here? Like, why are they on earth? Even if they just believe they came from primordial ooze and they're here by accident, life's deterministic. Like, I want to understand, what's their framework? Like, what is their operating system every day when they get up and go about life? And then what do they believe is their redemption, or what's wrong with the world? I want to understand those things. And then you're listening for just some of those accounts of like, every single person, if you talk to them long enough, they'll tell you pretty quickly what they think the world ought to look like. And who ought to be in control, and what ought to happen, and all of those things along the way. And as you do that, you are hearing all sorts of language that's infused with meaning, with morality, and with purpose. All of that. Like, you can't help but talk about your future and your family and your own life and not believe it has some sense of meaning and purpose. I've done enough weddings over the years that I've seen too many brides walk down an aisle, and I see a groom sit there and tear up as he sees his bride. Yeah. And in that moment, he's not just going, I'm having a chemical reaction to seeing my bride. And no. Instead, he's weeping at the beauty of his bride. So all of us have those moments where we're experiencing beauty, and I want to lean into that. Most of the people I come across, they've got hobbies because they love the outdoors. They love creation. I just want them to also know who the Creator is. And here's what I would say, too, as that relationship builds. I've had this conversation with folks. It's not a question sometimes, too, of like, do you need God? It's a question of, if God is real, you're going to have to deal with Him. Mm. Because you are in His world. you are operating in his domain. And if that's the case, you're going to want to be in right relationship with him. And that is me kind of breaking through the secular too, because some folks think like, well, God's what you do in the case of emergency. You break glass and you pull God off the shelf. And it's like, well, no, we're living in his house. So we're the ones that have come into his world. And if that's the case, you better be on good terms with him.
That's right.
So it's not a question of just like, do you need God or do you want to be part of your life? The question is, you are going to have a relationship with God. It's just a question, is it going to be one for ruination or restoration?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we just have to like, if that's how we want to be enchanted, we have to remember we really are in God's world. Yeah. It's not my world.
Yeah.
So it's God's world.
That's a much better approach than I had. I tend to invite them to a sleepover at a haunted house, but I think I'll redo my approach.
Read Harry Potter.
Yeah, yeah. In a haunted house. Yeah. And then we listen to Jimmy's Our Ghosts Are Real Clearly podcast.
I like it.
Yeah.
Hey, good shout out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think when I think about an approach, you know, oftentimes this whole secular story began with disenfranchisement, right? So disenfranchisement's different than disenchanted. Disenfranchisement is I've been lied to. I've been hurt. I've been taken advantage of. I've been duped. The snake oil salesman saw me coming, and I gave him my money, and I'm not going to let that happen again. So a lot of people are not so much afraid of an enchanted world, right? They need to see it's enchanted, for sure. So Ryan's right in the sense of we need to re-enchant it. We have to remember that the whole story started with abuse that was highlighted, with people who had given a false gospel. So one of the ways you can re-enchant a secularist worldview is to let them see an enchanted Christian. An enchanted Christian. We want to be enchanting people, don't we? Like, it's like, what kind of person would it be just like when you enter the room, people are like, something magical is happening with this person. Like I don't feel the same way as I do around other people. So if you want to help bring people back into an enchanted world, you need to invite them into that enchantment, but you've got to be enchanting. And if you're grumpy, cold-hearted, angry, you know, you're just not going to be that. So we begin by giving them an enchanted experience of hospitality. I love it when people walk in my house and they'd be like, nobody's cooked for us like this. Nobody's really offered us, you know. It's like my fridge is your fridge. You can have it. I want it to feel. That's the whole point about evangelism as hospitality. You're going to experience an enchantment in my house that you don't experience out in the world. I want you to walk out of here thinking that that's really special. And if all the things you had passed judgment on, like people just don't do this anymore, if that was wrong, what else can we find you were wrong about? And we'll get there. All right, so. It's my encouragement to you.
It's a good word.